Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
He realized he was clenching his fists and willed them to relax. "I'm gonna go," he said. "Thank you. I'm sorry." He began moving toward the door.
"You don't have to," said Gary.
Too late, J.W. realized he'd left his big book on the chair. He grabbed another one from the table and hurried out.
"Addiction is cunning, baffling, and powerful," he heard Gary call after him as he headed for the stairs. "It's other people that keep us sane. You can come back any time."
He took the stairs two at a time and pushed the door open, stepping out into the fresh air and sunshine. He was angry with himself for becoming combative and sarcastic. It was shameful, really, the way he had conducted himself. Maybe there were things he could have picked up by sitting in the back of a meeting like that. The gravel was littered with cigarette butts and withered dandelions. There were polished flecks of green glass from an old Mountain Dew bottle mixed in with the rocks near his car. He got in and closed the door. He inhaled the sweltering air, turned the key and let the air conditioner blast dust at him. Then he pulled back out onto the highway and headed toward town. Some 10 minutes later, J.W. pulled up and parked in front of his house, still jangled and full of self-recrimination. It was shortly after noon. He wanted to catch Carol, and he knew that she usually tried to eat lunch at home, where she could listen to the midday program on public radio. He got out, walked up to the house, and rang the glowing round doorbell. He waited a moment. Maybe he should have stayed in that meeting. He felt as if he had made a choice between two paths without realizing it. But he also knew that he was being overly dramatic. He could always go back, as Gary had said. Any time. He rang the doorbell again. He heard the sound of a squeaking floorboard just inside, and then the door was unlocked and swung inward. "John!" Carol smiled nervously at him. Her face was flushed, and she seemed pleasantly surprised and a bit out of breath. She stepped out, pulling the door partially shut behind her. Her shoulder-length blonde hair fell in loose, shaggy locks around her face. He recognized a cubic zirconium necklace around her neck, just like the one he had seen on the Home Shopping Network. It struck him as odd that she would buy something like that for herself, especially now. Still, seeing her somehow made him feel relieved and normal again. "Hey," he said. "You look awful." She smiled quizzically and pulled a lock from her face.
"I tried calling a number of times."
She frowned and smiled at the same time, a mixed expression that he had always found endearing in its impenetrability. "John, you stood me up. I waited up till after 11. "I know. I'm sorry. You got time for lunch?" "No, I don't. I have a meeting today." "A meeting?" "Yeah, I told you. Jim Franklin's taking me to the new agent's luncheon." He nodded. She had said that. Then he heard the squeaky floorboard inside. A flicker of insecurity darted across Carol's face, and in that instant, the mirage of old times evaporated. She moved partway back through the door. Behind her in the foyer stood Jim Franklin, a blow-dried insurance agent in his early 40s whom J.W. had always disliked. Carol's thin brows knit together, and she looked down, moving the hair back behind her ear. "John," Franklin said in a glad-handing tone as he shrugged into his suit coat behind her. "How was the conference?" J.W. wanted to believe that it was all a big mistake, that Jim Franklin wasn't really there in his house in the middle of the day with Carol, who had been slow to answer the door. Jim Franklin, who knew about his travel schedule. "I'm fine, Jim," he managed to get out. He turned back to Carol. "Is Julie home?" "You know she's at school." but her voice had a little break in it as she realized why he had asked. The sky seemed to tilt in her eyes.
"It's not what you think," she said. "We have to run. We can talk later."
She and Jim stepped outside. She pulled the door shut and locked it as Jim gave J.W. a little wave and a winking nod and headed toward his sports car, which was partially obscured by the evergreens at the corner of the house. He nodded to Carol.
"Call my cell."
"Okay."
He watched her hurry after Jim, and then the car pulled out. They both waved. He waved back. It was a fine day, and anyone watching would have thought the waves festive, the beginning of something fun. J.W. walked to his car across the street, the sky beating down on him with the light of a desert. His hands were numb, despite the heat, as if his arteries had been cut at the armpits. In the brilliant sunshine, he could really see how filthy his car was, and that there was a rust speck forming on the lower portion of his door. He'd have to wash it, but the rust would be harder to fix. He got in and set out for the Northland Mall. He gripped the wheel tightly. It couldn't be. It was too fast. They'd only been separated for a few months. And after all, she had said it wasn't what it looked like. He thought about their daughter, Julie. In all this, it was time with her he most looked forward to, but they hadn't had much of it lately. In some ways, Julie had more in common with him than she did with Carol. She was interested in things, in nature, in animals, in science. While Carol was practical and family-oriented and tradition-bound, Julie was an impractical dreamer. He loved that about her, and he had always encouraged it. Beyond their birthday excursions and camping trips with the Brownies, Julie and J.W. talked about science and the universe on trips to the grocery store or to the Northland Mall. On one of their trips together, driving to visit his father as he was dying of cirrhosis in the hospital in Fargo, Julie read a book on evolution, which J.W. had bought her secretly, since Carol didn't want her reading books that openly defied the pastor's sermons. He watched the light reflect in her glasses as she read to him about the geological clock.
1 hour equals about 400 million years, she told him with awe.
He watched her face fill with excitement as she pondered that sense of scale, and how so much that we think of as ancient is crowded in at the end of the 11th hour.
Amazing, he acknowledged, shaking his head in wonder.
She read on.
The earliest human ancestors we've discovered are about 4 million years old, and that's at 1159-24. And the start of human civilization? Everything we know, everything we have done since the beginning of history, all the roads and towns and cities we've built, all that has happened in the last one-third of the last second, the time it takes to snap your fingers.
She looked out the car window and shook her head.
It's like an explosion.
He missed Julie with an almost palpable longing. Part of the distance that had emerged between them was her age, he knew, and the social demands of junior high. He remembered seventh grade, how brutal it was. Gone were the glasses. It was contacts and eyeliner now. And gone was the innocence. But a big part of it, most of it, he felt certain, was everything that had happened in the years since Chris died. He missed their dates and their car conversations and her unguarded exuberance in a way that made his heart ache. Northland Mall lay on the outskirts of Virginia, a town that seemed to him like a miniature version of Duluth, some 45 minutes down the highway from North Lake. Filled with the post-Victorian homes of mining executives and the scattered salt boxes of their minions, the city clawed its way up a giant hillside. Despite an early five-story brick attempt at a skyscraper downtown, the tallest building to date was the Water Tower. Up the hill, to the north and west, the vast mall occupied as much square footage as most of the downtown. When it was built, J.W. had been asked to be part of a consortium of banks that provided financing, together with the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, a government agency that was supposed to take the taconite production tax and reinvest it to stimulate the local economy. He had passed on the deal. It was too big for the area, his numbers said. After some modest initial success, the mall had fallen on hard times during the Great Recession, making his decision look prescient. Avoiding that loss was one of the reasons North Lake Bank had become a regional leader. He found a spot near the northeast entrance and walked across the potholed drive. Inside, he could hear the sound of a distant fountain in the main concourse. He headed past the Army-Navy Recruiting Center, a temp agency, a sleepy Chinese restaurant, and a Goodwill, then stepped into the Radio Shack. He was after something he'd seen in the store several years ago when he was looking for an electronics project as a Christmas gift for Chris. He made his way to the back. There it was, on a bottom shelf near the door to the back room, by the old Heath kits. Dusty and forgotten, the eavesdropping hobby kits packaging showed a 12-year-old boy listening on headphones to his mom and dad, who were in the other room. A bug hidden behind a chair emitted lines representing radio waves. The description said it had a range of 100 yards. J.W. stood, blew the dust off, and picked up some rosin core solder and a soldering iron from the opposite shelf. The clerk was a gregarious older man in a red Radio Shack golf shirt with silver hair and a bowl cut. More hair ran thick down his neck and arms and poked out in a tuft from his open collar. "You got a boy for that project?" he said jovially as he stuffed the merchandise into a small plastic shopping bag. "No," said J.W. His tone stopped the man short, but then he regretted his abruptness. "A daughter," he added. The clerk brightened immediately. "Well, she's like my granddaughter, then. When she's old enough, she says she's going to go down the hall here and join the army and be a techno queen. That's what I call her." J.W. smiled and nodded as the man printed his receipt. "You take care." He handed the bag over with a big smile. J.W. nodded again as he took it and left. Chapter 8. The sharp smell of hot solder filled J.W.'s nostrils as he bent over the speckled kitchen table. It was a warm afternoon, and beyond the window screens a breeze roiled the oaks in a constant sibilance, the leaves casting pale gray shadows that moved across the table like a flock of birds. He held the soldering iron to a sprig of copper wire bent through a hole in the silver end of an electronic component and touched it with solder. The wire shifted, and he moved the iron's beveled tip to better support it, then replaced the end of the solder against the wire. After a moment, it emitted a soft puff of smoke and melted into a silver ball that crawled up the copper and down onto the tab. It jiggled again as he removed the soldering iron, then skinned over. A second later, it had flashed into a duller gray, the tiny crystals in the metal locking into a new formation. He looked back at the pictogram in the instruction booklet, then slipped a thin green wire into the next tab. When it was done, J.W. put the final screws into the receiver, a brown plug-in box with two knobs and a pair of earbuds. A small round bug sat on the table as well, together with the solder, the iron, the Gambler's Anonymous big book, and a large framed photo of his family in happier days. He plugged in the receiver's cord, put the earbuds in, turned it on, and spoke into the bug like a microphone. "Testing?" It was the first thing he had said all day. He could hear it loud and clear over the receiver. He looked out the window at Eagle's black Bronco in the drive. The sky bloomed above the trees like a Scandinavian flower. He picked up his cell phone, scrolled to home, and pressed call. After a moment, he heard Carol's voice. "You've reached the White House. Leave a message." It was an old joke from a happier time. "Carol, it's John. Just calling you back. Hope your lunch went well. Anyway, I'm not at the apartment anymore. Call me, please. Love you." He hung up and stared out at the trees. The thought of Carol driving off in Jim's sports car made his chest tighten all over again, and now she wasn't calling him back. A noise drew his attention to the pole barn, the Stolpe Loven. He remembered his father calling theirs in Norwegian. They had a small one in the backyard where they stored the lawnmower and other items, ATVs he wasn't allowed to drive or speak of, chainsaws, bicycles, once even a shiny Harley-Davidson motorcycle that would mysteriously appear and then disappear into the van of a man with long hair and a beard after his father was laid off from the mine. "I'm selling them for a friend, but he's very embarrassed," his father explained. "Don't tell anyone." One day the police stopped by, asking about a stolen pair of snowmobiles. But by then his father was on the road selling cell tower leases. His mother was whispering in tongues, and the Stolpe Loven had been empty for some time. The large sliding doors of Eagle's pole barn opened to a cavern of shadow. Johnny Eagle and an older, stockier Indian man with a gray ponytail disappeared into the grainy murkiness, then reappeared a moment later. They each took a lawn and leaf bag from the bed of an old pickup truck and went back into the barn again. J.W. watched, wondering what they were up to. When they reemerged, the stocky man was carrying some white plastic bags. He threw them into the back of the pickup truck while Eagle pulled the big barn doors shut, and then they exchanged some money, and the man with the ponytail got into the truck and rumbled off. Eagle walked back up toward the house. J.W. organized the items on the table and sat back, waiting for Eagle to leave. He looked out the window again. The sun was high and the trailer was quiet. A slight breeze blew in through the screens. The lace-edged curtain turned over lazily. The buzzing of insects and the warm air soon sent him into a dozing memory. The smell of the solder and the old formica tabletop conjured up dreaming memories of childhood times spent with similar kits, which his dad got from a Radio Shack on special trips down to Duluth. You could build crystal radios, oscilloscopes, FM radios, alarm systems, a TV, or even a computer. J.W. looked forward to his father's homecomings partly because of these presents. His father spent most weeks, and sometimes months, on the road, but when he was home with a new kit, J.W. would pester him until he came down to the basement workshop. He would carry down a six-pack and a cooler, and a couple of Dorothy's root beers for J.W. The two of them would work until the early hours of the morning, his dad sipping beer after beer and telling stories of his time on the road selling leases for cell phone towers, or of how the Indians were organizing with the crazy enviros to block them. He'd sometimes take his Motorola cell phone out and show him. "See this?" he'd say, waving the briefcase-sized device. "This is freedom. Those idiots don't know what's good for them." Later, when the beers had set in, he would hunch over the workbench. "So," he'd say, "is she driving you crazy yet? You think you can handle this?" He was talking about J.W.'s mother. One day during the first summer his dad was mostly away on the road, J.W.'s mother was at the kitchen counter, bending over some pasties on the dough board, singing her special version of an old Finnish song. Then the aged Wainamoinen spoke aloud his songs of magic, and a flower-crowned birch grew upward, crowned with flowers and leaves all golden, and its summit reached to heaven, to the very clouds uprising. "You, my son, my Kalevala, my story of the north." And then, mid-verse, she stopped. She had always been a little artsy, and J.W. loved painting the lower cupboards with her, or making chalk masterpieces on the garage floor. But he sensed that this was different. She began seeing visions and speaking to invisible gods. She never sang a word again, but she whispered day and night. J.W. thought she had gone crazy right then and there, and in a way, she had. At the time, there was no way to know that a small frog was growing inside her brain, extending its little webbed feet, or that the tumor would eventually kill her when he was 13. J.W. was charged with taking care of her when his father was on the road and she was sick with the migraines, but she just lay there whispering verses, so he spent most of his time outdoors. In truth, she frightened him. It was as if some ghost spirit from the Finnish north had taken her, and when J.W. was around, it made her upset, so he avoided her as much as he could. During the early stages of his mother's illness, J.W. whiled away most of the time with his friends, Craig, and the twins, Keith and Kevin. They were outside from dawn until dusk, with only a few short breaks for meals or snacks at each other's houses. They spent part of one summer exploring the dump, climbing into rusting cars, turning their steering wheels, the spice of dust, mold, and old tobacco smoke lifting from the seat stuffing. And they loved to play in the trees, climbing from one to another to avoid the sharks and lava below. But J.W.'s favorite game had always been Cowboys and Indians. Craig's mother said the game was crude, and she was surprised that Keith and Kevin, who were half Ojibwe, went along with it. But the game's historical connotations never seemed to matter to the twins. In fact, J.W. usually played the Indian, while Keith and Kevin and Craig all pretended to be cowboys. They would share a root beer, pretend to get drunk, and then ride in a posse to hunt J.W. down. J.W. had always admired the Indian braves in TV shows, how they hopped on horses and rode bareback while shooting arrows at their enemies at a full gallop. Some days he even put on war paint and a headdress and bet them each 50 cents they couldn't find him before he could shoot them. They'd count to 100 while he ran into the woods by the wetlands, where the cottonwoods and the buckthorn gave way to a green algae pond. He'd hide up in the trees and wait patiently, planning what he would do with the money. J.W. woke thick-headed and woozy in the wash light of mid-afternoon. It took him a moment to remember where he was, but the musty smell of the trailer brought him back. He heard the sound of a car door slamming, and then the sound of an engine turning over. He looked out and saw Johnny Eagle backing his Bronco out of the driveway. It headed slowly around the bend toward the reservation road. He checked his watch. It was a little after 2. The boy wouldn't be home from school for another hour and 10 minutes, if the pattern of the past few days held. He stood, took the little round bug from the table, and stepped out through the flimsy aluminum door. The wooden steps were catching a spot of sunlight. He could feel the warmth through his jeans as he stepped down onto the grassy gravel. He pushed the door shut behind him and looked around. There was no sign of life at Eagle's house or at the white brick house farther up the hill. He looked back up the lane toward the trailer park, but no one appeared to be up that way either. It was now or never. His heart picked up speed as he stepped onto the dirt road. His fingers felt tight. He stretched them and crossed toward the riding ring and then onto Eagle's lawn. The horse stood in a makeshift stall of 2x6s inside a metal lean-to. It snorted at him with an air of concern. He crossed uphill toward the house, which had even taller trees behind it. He strolled up the white concrete walk toward the front door, trying to appear relaxed in case someone happened to be watching. Ranks of orange and green lilies stood at attention. He looked into the dark pool of a window. Everything still. He stepped onto the low front porch. His heart was pounding. A bristly brown mat in front of the door bore the word Bendigun. He didn't belong here. This wasn't the sort of thing he did. He pulled open the wooden screen door, knocked on the carved main door. His fingers were numb. There was no sound. He glanced over his shoulder to see if anyone was watching. His chest felt tight. He noticed the doorbell, a glowing yellow rectangle. He pressed it, and an old bell echoed inside, but there was no reaction. He looked behind him again, and up the trailer park lane across the street. From here he could see the tops of a few trailers poking over the hill. His hand closed around the knob, feeling cold and weak. It turned. He paused, then pushed the door open and stepped inside.
"Hello? Anybody home? Mr. Eagle? Hello?"
The interior was themed in rustic wood and native-style decor. To his right stood an unfinished room of studs and insulation. Ahead, the foyer opened into a large eating area, with a broad library table covered with piles of papers and books. The floor was wide plank wood, marred and finished with a dull wax. To the right of the eating area was the kitchen. Despite the fact that it was only partially finished, it had massive granite countertops, a breakfast bar, a deep sink, and stainless steel appliances. To his immediate left was a corridor leading to the bedrooms. The central air conditioning kicked on with a cool whir. J.W. headed down the corridor in search of an office. His heart was pounding. On the wall was a family photo of the boy, much younger, perhaps 10, with Eagle and a woman, presumably his mother. After pausing at it briefly, J.W. continued, past a bathroom, to a door that stood open to a masculine, native-themed room with a queen-sized bed. Opposite, he could see into the messy cave of a teenage boy, clothing piled in mounds, soda bottles, chips, textbooks, and notebooks on the bed, an older laptop computer and some comic books piled atop an empty terrarium, the smell of dirty laundry and Doritos. J.W. returned to the door opposite the bathroom. It was closed but not latched. There could be someone inside, he worried. An aging grandparent, or someone sleeping. He took a soft step closer, but a floorboard creaked under the carpeting, giving him away. He froze. He had never done anything like this, and he had no idea what to expect or how to react if there was someone inside the room. He waited a moment, still, but there was no answer. He pushed the door open slowly with his shirt cuff and saw that there was no one. He stepped into a home office. More native decor, and the faint smell of cigar smoke. Wooden louver blinds like those at the bank hung over the windows. There was a large wooden desk, antique, 1940s design, and a black Herman Miller Aeron chair. The wall to the right was covered with a modular birch bookcase, Scandinavian style, that was divided into boxes of different sizes, with books in some places and knickknacks in others. J.W. crossed to the desk.
You have been listening to Episode 6 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 7 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.